The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, your weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with The China Project. Subscribe to Access from The China Project to get access to not only our great newsletter, The Daily Dispatch, but to all of the original writing on our website at thechinaproject.com. We've got reported stories, essays and editorials, great explainers, regular columns, and of course, a growing library of podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim peoples in China's Xinjiang region to Beijing's ambitious plans to shift the Chinese economy onto a post-carbon footing. It is a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We cover China with neither fear nor favor. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. My guest today is Representative Rick Larson of the Washington 2nd District. Congressman Larson is one of the founders and co-chairs of the House's bipartisan U.S.-China Working Group, which he helped start back in 2005, I believe. He's been very active in China policy over the years and has consistently been one of the real voices of reason and moderation in Congress when it comes to U.S. policy toward China. I first met Congressman Larson in Beijing about, 8 years ago or so, when he was part of a congressional delegation brought to Beijing by the National Committee. Earlier this summer, Congressman Larson published what I thought was an excellent white paper on U.S.-China relations titled A Four-Point Strategy to Enhance U.S. Competitiveness and Leadership. It was an update of a white paper addressing many of the same issues that he published in 2019, and which I also found to be eminently reasonable, full of ideas that I would personally love to have seen discussed more widely, and not just in Congress, but in the White House as well, and in the broader American conversation on China. Congressman Larson, thank you so much for making the time, and welcome to Seneca.
Thanks thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's good to be on and glad to recognize the work in the white paper. You call it, a voice of reason and moderation. Not a lot of that regarding U.S.-China relations in Congress these days.
No, indeed.
But despite the fact that I think there's a reality to the difficulty of the relationship, there's still a reasonable approach to take.
That's right.
While also being, very, very firm and strong in U.S. policy towards China, its leadership and its actions.
Preaching to the choir. Absolutely. Before we dive into the white paper, can you tell me a little bit about the U.S.-China Working Group that you started, its history? What has it been up to, especially just in the very trying times for the bilateral relationship since, say, 2017?
Yeah, sure. So since we started this in 2005 with Mark Kirk, or representative at the time, Representative Mark Kirk, later Senator Mark Kirk, Charles Bustani then became the chair. He's a representative from Louisiana. And then Darren LaHood from Illinois is now the Republican co-chair. I've been the consistent Democratic co-chair of this group. And over that period of time, I've made the trip to China 11 times. The last trip we took was in March of 2019. There were six members of Congress on that trip. We tried to take three Democrats, three Republicans each time we go over, but haven't been over since, obviously because of COVID. And we're looking for an opportunity to get back there. I think there is I think from reports back to me is that there is a desire on behalf of the National People's Congress leadership that members of Congress do go visit China again. It is problematic. You mentioned 2017. It's problematic these days because the center of gravity in the U.S. Congress, especially in the U.S. House, has shifted to be much more hawk-like than, say, being engagers. I like to say members of Congress are they're no longer national security, economic, or human rights hawks. There's punishers, decouplers, and engagers. Folks who want to use policy to punish China, folks who just want to decouple from China, and then the few and the proud, I guess the folks who recognize, despite the challenges, very real challenges, there's the need to engage with Chinese leadership on any number of issues.
That's right. This new taxonomy of yours, I think, is excellent. It works well. I think you used the word salvagers rather than engagers. I still maybe some residual allergy to the E word.
It might be. But might be salvagers, but to do that, you have to engage.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned that you'd published an earlier iteration of the paper in 2019, but as you rightly note, you know, quite a bit has happened since then, and not just in terms of China's, you know, even deeper authoritarian turn, but also developments in the United States within American society. What are some of the major changes that you felt you needed to address in this updated white paper, and what are the new priorities and recommendations that are chiefly responses to the new reality that we face?
Yeah, well, I think a white paper like this has to live in the real world,
right?
If you will, think about it that way. And in 2019, I was thinking that, well, the policy of the previous administration was just going to be that, just previous administration's policies towards the relationship with China. But even then, the previous administration was kind of bifurcated. The president at the time calling President Xi a good friend and wanted to get along with him and people like Putin, while at the same time the policies themselves were fairly fairly strict, fairly tough, especially on trade, so on. So thinking that the Biden administration would come in and maybe adjust a little bit, if not a lot, that didn't really happen. The Biden administration sort of kept full bore on the trade tariff policy and a few other things, but still I would argue they have changed tack a lot when it comes to engaging for some constructive dialogue. And so I wanted to kind of update this paper to say, okay, got it, we're going to have a tougher generally U.S. policy towards China, and its leadership decisions is going to be generally tougher than it has been under, say, the Clinton, Bush, Obama years. Let's accept that as a reality. Given that, one of the things that I was, preaching before the administration came in 21 was that no matter what it did, the U.S. Congress was not going to budge any at all on either human rights abuses in China or on technology policy. So and that was basically Huawei and ZTE. Obviously, it's much deeper than that when you look at artificial intelligence. You look at the CHIPS Act, CHIPS and Science Act that we passed in the United States, and what that means for, as an underlying foundational policy that impacts a lot of other technologies. And so my view is, okay, if this administration is going to continue to take a tough line, what does it need to stay tough on, at least from a political perspective, working with Congress, but also what are those opportunities that can still exist, so there's that level of engagement that's necessary when you have the two largest economies in the world and the two largest carbon emitters in the world and nuclear weapons held by both countries and so on. There has to be a place where they can talk.
That's right. So just now you've laid out a few things where you take issue, maybe perhaps, or maybe cherished hopes that the Biden administration would change tack a bit. There is other implied criticism of the Biden administration's current policy approach in this white paper. One of the main themes in Biden's approach that you seem to take issue with, I hope I'm not reading too much into this, is the administration's tendency to sort of divide the world into blocks in a way that you suggest is reminiscent of the Cold War. I mean, you don't say this explicitly, but the way that the Biden team has tended to talk about these in terms of China and the United States is in democracies versus authoritarian regimes. I'm wondering whether you could speak directly to that aspect of block thinking. What, if anything, do you see as the danger of that kind of bifurcation?
Yeah, I don't. I think that in Congress you hear that a lot more than you might from the Biden team. The language I use when I talk about U.S. roles in the world is, you know, allies, partners, and friends. So when you have the president go to G20 here in early September, when we're doing this podcast, you're going to G20, and then coming back from the G20, you'll be stopping in Vietnam. No one would argue Vietnam is a democracy. They would argue it is an authoritarian country, a communist party-led country.
Right.
And yet, it is going to be an important partner for the United States. And I think from Vietnam's perspective, it wants to be a partner with the United States. It'll never be an ally. It'll be a democratic partner. But we have need to build a strong relationship with Vietnam. There are trade issues that are important to the Vietnamese leadership with the United States. And there's also, from a Vietnamese government perspective, they want to, I would guess, they would never say this, but they'd want to hedge against their large northern neighbor, China. And that's in U.S. interests as well. So the idea that there's block created going on between democracy and authoritarianism is, I don't think I should be making that broader case. But when it comes to what I think Chinese government is trying to do in developing its friends and partners, I would say it'd be a stretch to say partners and friends of China. So the Chinese government doesn't think they want friends or partners; they want countries I think they can influence for other reasons. But I do think it's important that the U.S. avoid Cold War type of blocks, but also it's in our interest to have friends, partners, and allies for a lot of reasons. And one of the points in my paper is that this isn't just about U.S.-China. The U.S.-China relationship is not a bilateral relationship. It is influenced by so many other relationships that the U.S. has with other countries. And it is in our U.S. interests to develop relationships with these other countries. And it helps counter China. It can maybe help shape the environment in which Chinese leadership makes decisions as well. But for its own sake, these relationships can improve U.S. interests for our own domestic economy when it comes to trade, as well as for global engagement on any number of issues, whether that's at the UN or in natural disaster response or developing other national security relationships. We should be doing some of this stuff for our own reasons, regardless of what China's role in the world is.
Yeah, and that's the theme I want to get to in a bit. Let's dive, though, first into the meat of your white paper. You put forward four guiding principles behind this four-point strategy, and these are, just in your own words, one, recognizing existing areas of conflict and competition; two, expanding the playbook to include both offensive and defensive measures to compete with China; three, identifying areas where cooperation is in both nations' interest; and four, getting our own house in order. So there's a lot to get into here, but first let me ask you about this. Like, the first three of these really don't deviate that far, at least from the way Secretary Blinken has formulated things, you know, compete with confidence, cooperate where we can, contest when and where we must. He said this in a bunch of different sort of permutations. He also said things like, you know, China policy toward China will be competitive when it should be, collaborative when it can be, and adversarial when it must be. But, you know, the three C's, right, are there. And, you know, so it doesn't, you're pretty much on board with this idea. Is that right?
Pretty much on board with the idea. I think that whatever U.S. policy is going to be, it has to leave room for the engagement side of the relationship. There are current differences. There are very real differences. It isn't, you know, we're not in the Clinton, Bush, Obama era of U.S.-China relations. It's a very different world these days. But that said, we need to leave the room for collaboration, for engagement. So yeah, generally I'm okay there. And I think maybe you're going to get to the fourth thing. I got something to say.
Yeah. Which is, I think, it's great that you include that. That was part of the 2019 as well. But I think you hit that even harder this time, in part because there were so many other things that need to be gotten in order.
Right. So what's happened now, this fourth point is getting our own house in order, is it's good for its own sake, but my criticism, if you will, of the Biden administration, this is not breaking news, I've been really clear to everybody about this, is what was the purpose of all this? Like, so we passed the bipartisan infrastructure law in the United States to invest long-term in the basic foundational infrastructure that keeps our economy moving. Roads, bridges, highways, transit, broadband, all these great things. We passed the Chips and Science Act in order to deal with the issue of microchips and how important those are to longer-term growth. We passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really the driver of energy transition, the green transition.
That's right.
In the United States and in the world as well. Okay, we've done all that. Now, my view is, like, great, now we've done that, now we should go out into the world and say the U.S. has got its economic house in order. We are stronger for it domestically. And because of that, we can now confidently go into the rest of the world on the economic platform and on trade issues, and use this strength that we're building at home to make us stronger abroad. In particular, I mentioned the CPTPP.
Yeah.
No matter where you go, you hear about the criticism towards the U.S. about trade is like, you have this, U.S. has put together this Indo-Pacific economic framework, but it doesn't allow market access.
That's right.
That is, everyone wants trade agreements, but they don't really want trade agreements. They really want market access. And that's my criticism of our partners who are complaining about IPAF.
Yeah.
It's always only about, we want access to the U.S. market. It's fine. But the U.S. MCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, was actually based on the TPP, and we actually, use the TPP to make sure environment was part of trading, make sure labor was part of trading. We also have this whole discussion about state-owned enterprises as part of the TPP debate. It didn't need to be in the USMCA, but the point is trade agreements are more than market access. They're about standards and setting standards.
Yeah.
So I'm just leading up to the punchline here is that getting our own house in order was one thing. Now we need to use that to go out there and push on these higher standard trade agreements, and we're not doing that. And if we do that, it is a actual strategic action that we can take with fragile partners and allies that actually can help shape China's leadership's decisions on trade in the world. And right now we're giving up that space, I think. And so my point about number four, again, our own domestic house in order, is, hey, we've done it. Now what are you going to do with it? And we need to do more with it, because it does have an impact on the U.S.-China relationship.
You take these four pillars, basically, and you apply them across a number of issue areas. Just now we talked about how it may be applicable, especially that fourth pillar, in terms of this one that you call jobs, business, investment, and trade. But again, there are five different issue areas that you look at. You start with national security. You go on to development and diplomacy, which I thought was a very interesting section. Doesn't get a lot of attention, I think, than it probably should. Technology, naturally, which really touches on all of the other ones. And education. So I want to go through these different issue areas. And while we perhaps can't get into too much detail on them, you can maybe highlight a few of the main points that you'd want to, accentuate in each, where we are getting things wrong, and maybe what you suggest we should be doing instead. Now, there are a few points in particular under each that I do want to touch on. You've anticipated one of them, which was rejoining CPTPP. We'll get to that, but let's do these in order. And let's start with Taiwan. And the one that I really wanted to highlight is your position on U.S. policy toward Taiwan, where you advocate continuing the policy of strategic ambiguity.
Yeah, I don't think it's in our interests, in U.S. interests, to be very open and specific about what we would do in response to Chinese aggression towards Taiwan, whatever that, invasion would be the extreme case, but what we would do with regards to Chinese action in Taiwan, because I think it helps maintain that ambiguity, I think helps maintain stability. Now, I used to be in the majority in Congress on that issue. I'm no longer. There's been a shift in Congress to be much more specific about what we would do, and also being much more aggressive about arming Taiwan. There are challenges to that for a lot of reasons. One of the biggest challenges is Taiwan's own military and its own policies and what it wants to do versus what it might be in its best interest to do. But that's a Department of Defense debate and Armed Services debate about how to help Taiwan. But I do think the strategic ambiguity ought to be a fundamental part of the policy, as well as continuing to press for, say, any changes that need to be diplomacy and dialogue, because conflict in the Taiwan Strait is not just bad for the region, it would be bad for the world.
Right. The next section, I hate giving such short shrift to do something as big as national security, but it's a 22-page document. I invite everyone to read. In fact, I hope that everyone does, because you can sit down in one deep breath, you can But it is chock full of ideas. This next section on development and diplomacy, much of what you wrote focuses on American responses to China's Belt and Road Initiative, now 10 years old. So perhaps you could unpack maybe the approach that you advocate on that front. What should we be doing to counter? Should we be, you know, cheering for its failures, or should we be offering something else?
Yeah. It's a great way to put the question, because I don't think any of my paper cheers for China's failures.
That's right.
Anything. What it's really pushing is that the U.S. needs to do something. This is like this. Don't approach this with a defensive playbook. What can we do on offense?
Right.
It's an analogy that, you know, I grew up playing high school football here in the United States, so I don't know if the analogy applies to everybody, but, you know, the playbook has to have offense, and then we need to go on offense in the world when it comes to development and diplomacy as well. So just offering, just saying, don't do BRI, just say no to all this free money, quote unquote free money that China is offering, is not a message that's going to work in the developing world of global South these days. It clearly isn't working. And so now we have tools, and we made some changes over the last several years, including the Development Finance Corporation, the DFC changes that we passed that. We've got the Export-Import Bank. We've got other tools. And using them collectively doesn't result in a BRI-like or sized type of effort. But it is what the U.S. can offer, and we ought to be offering to some of these countries. So I just think that there's a better, you know, the administration recognizes this. I think it can be better on it. But I do think that we do have some tools on the development side that can be used to not directly counter, but to show that the U.S. is playing in the world as well in some of these areas that are important internationally for development.
Right. I mean, this is exactly what you hear anytime you talk to an development economist or anyone from the global South. They say, you know, what's your counter, and why don't you show up when the Chinese always do, right? We need, you know, the America comes to town and we get a lecture, China comes to town and we get a hospital, that sort of thing, right?
They'll get a hospital with Chinese doctors and Chinese nurses and Chinese, yeah, right, and Chinese workers building the hospital. I mean, that part of what we're trying to, I think, try to communicate is that, well, we can help you build your hospital, we can, and have your workers do it, and so on. But some of this isn't only on the United States. Some of these countries have leaders who make choices as well that can be really great, and sometimes they're not. And that's not on the U.S. But we can do better what the tools we have.
Sure. Under jobs, business, investment, and trade, we've spoken a little bit about your, you know, call for the U.S. to join the CPTPP. The Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, but make the case that that ship hasn't already sailed. I mean, that, you know, if by some chance there really were a will in America, there would still be a way. We talk about this a lot. I mean, obviously, I would love to see it, you know, join that and RCEP as well. But there seems to be so little appetite for multilateral trade agreements right now in America.
There is very little appetite. There's no doubt about it. But yeah, say make the case the ship hasn't yet sailed. And this, Kaiser, one thing you have to know about members of Congress is that we always believe we can do something.
So,
despite everything else, we always believe. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a member of Congress.
That's right.
And we are naively optimistic as a group of people. Always thinking we can get something done despite the odds, and I do think the CPTPP is one of those areas where the red carpet hasn't been rolled up, for the United States. And so, in fact, again, there's a better strategic reason. If there's one thing that we could do in all the things I wrote in the paper, by the way, so most of these are not my ideas. I endorse them, but I try to collect ideas, and then the ones I like, that, you know, try to package them together to create a thing. So I don't want to be the whole paper and all the ideas I'll take criticism for, but I'm borrowing ideas. But the CPTPP joining that is like the one main idea in this paper that literally is, U.S., you want to do better against China? Join the CPTPP.
What?
Right? We get a lot else going with it, if we join the CPTPP. But it is the one big strategic step the United States can take that communicates throughout all of the Indo-Pacific, all of Asia, that the U.S. is here. It's a Pacific country. We aren't leaving. And that in and of itself would be a big, important message to the Chinese leadership. That said, we'd also benefit from it as a country with developing these trade relationships with the other partners in the agreement. But it is the one idea that would really force China to sit up and take Chinese leadership to sit up and take notice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a kind of ironic tragedy that the original TPP, so many of the sort of high quality elements of that were the result of American participation in the negotiations for it. And then,
if this was a publishing deal, the United States should be suing for plagiarism because we wrote it, right? We wrote the damn thing, and now everyone else is using it. So,
well, we did walk away from it. We
I understand. I didn't support it. I was there when it happened, and
yeah, real pity. So under tech, which is sort of in my wheelhouse, I watch a lot of this stuff. I couldn't agree with you more, 100% behind some of the points that you make, especially about attracting talent through, encouraging easier H-1B visas and the like. I was more interested, though, in what you didn't say. I don't think I'm reading too much into this. So earlier in your white paper, you this is well ahead of the tech section, you say that you're not happy with things like the aggressive export controls. What you say is, you see this as kind of defensive. It's trip the other guy rather than run faster. It's the kind of defensive strategy that you warn against us pursuing, to the exclusion of offense. So let me quote yourself. You said, if the goal of U.S. strategy is to slow China's growth, it is doomed to failure. Totally agree. But you don't talk about in the tech section these things like the really strict export controls on advanced integrated circuits on advanced chips and the equipment that's needed to design and manufacture them.
That issue was developing as I was writing this. So, a lot of these announcements had just come out relatively recently.
October,
And so I think in the next iteration, we'll probably take a look at that, look at the issue of chips more specifically, and determine what we can do, what we ought to do. But I do think that the fundamental point I'm still making is that what can we do?
Right.
I do think looking back at the late 90s, I think what I forget the exact name, but it was had to do with the rocket technology. And the U.S. put some restrictions on technology going to China, in hopes that it would prevent this Chinese space program from ever happening.
Yeah, that was the culmination was in 2011 with the Wolf Amendment.
Yeah, yeah. Preventing NASA and the Chinese Space Agency from cooperating. How well did that work to stop the Chinese space program?
Right.
Right? It didn't. There's the Chinese leadership has the incentive to create and build up its own tech sector, which I fully understand. We don't have to play by their rules, and nor should we play by their rules as they do that. But we ought to keep in mind how effective or ineffective, as well as what the collateral damage is to U.S. or partners' own technology economies from our actions. And so being more discerning about export controls is important. I think the administration is trying to do that. I think they are trying to do that. I don't think Congress wants the administration to be more discerning. It's the decouplers argument,
right?
That I think is just doomed to fail. I mean, the companies, I won't name names, but large tractor construction companies aren't leaving China. Large airplane manufacturers based in the United States aren't leaving China. They're not decoupling. They're not getting out of that market. So we need to have something much more realistic when it comes to thinking about export controls.
Right. Can't imagine which airplane manufacturer you're talking about.
Can't imagine.
I mean, you do represent the 2nd District.
I do, yeah. And the wonderful women and men who build those airplanes.
That's right. So on to education, I'm again once completely all in with the proposals that you make. But what I thought was really interesting here was that you take the opportunity in this section to really hit this idea that everything that we do shouldn't be all about competing with China. I'm reminded of something that Ryan Haas once said on this program. You quote from his, or you don't quote from, but you know, you include his book very prominently in your bibliography. I love that book, which is, you know, very much in line with what you've argued this whole time.
Yeah.
Stronger, right? Yeah. Ryan said, you know, China has become the policy equivalent of duct tape, right? You want to fix American infrastructure? Yeah, talk about China. You want to, you know, give NATO a new mission? Talk about China. He's saying, you know, we're going to be using China to sell babies' nappies soon.
The old reliable.
That's right. Yeah. Anyway, I agree that, you know, the American education system is something we should be investing in absolutely irrespective of China. But here we are with, you know, you, Congressman Larson, writing about this, writing about investing in education in this section of a white paper on competing with China. Yeah. What do you do? What are the points in education investment that you want to hit? Because, again, you know, it's not unpredictable. It's you're talking about STEM education, about but I think one of the things that I liked about it was that you were clearly talking also about the deleterious effects of the China initiative, right?
Yeah, and I think it sounds like generally have moved past that. But again, this is an issue where the concerns are real, but let's be discerning about it. That's right. Not to say if a person has either is a Chinese national working in research in the United States, or forbid is a Chinese American with what people say it would be a Chinese name, that they're suddenly a danger, which again, that's basically what was happening as well,
right?
In the mid 2010s, that those folks are themselves inherently a danger. But what can we do to say, well, okay, let's educate our universities, let's educate our research institutions. What is happening? What is going on? Why is this important? Why is it important to them? And it's more work. it's tougher to do that, but it also, you know, might be much more effective. And in fact, from what we know, the China initiative, it really wasn't all that effective.
Yeah.
In and of itself. These are cases very hard to make, because if you don't really work hard at trying to make the cases, then the courts will throw them out, which is kind of what
happened. Yeah.
So we could, but combining sort of this, let's educate the institutions, educate research institutions, the educational institutions, the faculty, focus on that side. And then obviously academic espionage is real. It's not new. Let's not trick ourselves into thinking that this is something that just happened over the last 25 years. Then let's focus on those cases that are best to make and most impactful to make. And so, again, it's not saying don't do some of these things from a law enforcement perspective, but it's saying like what is the better approach to be effective, so that good quality research that can help the global commons be successful isn't stolen.
There is a through line through the entire thing that basically says, look, American strength comes from openness. It comes from, you know, tolerance and diversity, and that, you know, we're threatening the very things that make us who we are
it's almost like in crisis we're like losing trust in ourselves.
That's right.
When in fact this analogy is going to be totally, it might be lost in some of your folks, I don't know, but we're all Simpsons fans, so there's a great
absolutely.
Scene in the Simpsons where there's some crisis is happening and Homer turns to Bart and like grabs him and starts shaking him. And Bart says, what do I do? What do I do? And Homer says, I don't know, but in times of crisis, you go with what you know. And but that's just it. I mean, in times of crisis, the U.S. should go with what it knows. Like, and what we know is when we have invested in our people, we invested in our roads, bridges, highways, when we invested in our science and our education, when we have done those things, the result maybe has been 20 years down the road and it's a really great result, but it's always been a great result. Like, we go with what you know. And like, let's not, we don't necessarily change what we're doing because of China. Go with what we know and show the success of what we're doing. And everyone else will say, but you know, once again, we thought the U.S. was going to be down and out, and it wasn't. And I think we just, you know, that's a hopeful optimism that I have. But I, just because China is stronger, that has been, and it's more of a strategic competitor that has been, just because it doesn't mean the U.S. has to change everything that we're doing. We have strengths we need to build on and trust them. Trust those strengths. Go with what we know.
So I want to be mindful of your time. Just a couple of final questions for you. One is, what has the response been like to what you've written here within Congress, among your constituents in the Washington Second, and I mean the broader public?
I think within the U.S.-China relations community, it's been very positive. I think there's a desire for to have a congressional voice saying the things I'm saying. I think in Congress, it's an uphill battle. Again, the center of gravity has shifted. I have shifted myself. My center of gravity has shifted.
Sure.
I'm a little tougher than I was 15 years ago when it comes to U.S.-China relations, but that's the reality of U.S.-China relations. It has shifted, and as a policymaker, I need to shift some with it, but you know, I'm trying to stick to my guns a little bit, stick to my principles about we still need engagement, we still need a relationship that is, you know, have frank and firm discussions. But in Congress, it's really tough because we have this two-year cycle elections, and China becomes an issue for some members of Congress, and it's better to be tougher than discerning. And so with members, it's tough. Although I have distributed this to the select committee and talked to a few of the Democratic colleagues about it. Certainly a Republican, Darren LaHood, he's on the select committee. And
that's right.
I want to be, this is my product, not his product. I want to be really clear about that. Same token, it's just tougher in Congress these days. But you got to play the long game on this, I would say, because I know the Chinese leadership is playing a long game on this and on the relationship. We need to have a long-term game that isn't, again, getting back to what I said earlier, Kaiser, the U.S.-China relationship is not, it sounds like a bilateral relationship. It is not a bilateral relationship. The U.S.-China relationship is a multilateral one, that the meaning that the U.S. Has a stronger position if it works with friends, partners, and allies to advance U.S. interests relative to the United States and U.S. interests relative to China.
That's right. And you mentioned just now the Select Committee, and I wanted to get your take on Representative Gallagher's committee. Who are some of the folks that are simpatico? I know Addie Kim, for example. You know, other people point to maybe Ro Khanna. Who's on the committee that you think, you know, is reachable for what we call salvagers?
Sure, salvagers. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I think that the thing to think about. I don't want to name names, because if I name some names, I'm not going to name other names. And I work with all these folks, so I have to maintain relationships with everybody on everything. But I would note that my guess is that, you know, when their report is done and it's all said and done, like 80 to 85% of it, it's going to be fairly agreeable.
Hmm.
You know, because there is some consensus on some things. And then there'll be that 10 to 15% that just is like, well, we're not going to, that's not where we're going to agree.
Right.
But
some of that is, you know, framing the very thing as an existential threat, which, you know, you certainly do not walk anywhere close to that line.
No. I always believe the existential threat to any country is itself, that's why I say we need to get our own house in order. We need to pursue our interests. We need to be active about that. I don't agree that China is an existential threat to the United States.
And finally, what's your sense of what's come out of recent months? Where we've seen Secretary Blinken, we've seen Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, and somewhere in there, Special Climate Envoy John Kerry, all make trips to China. Do you sense that there's an inflection happening over the summer, that things are going to come out, will enter the fall and with a different?
I think we're in a rebuilding mode. I mean, rebuilding those relationships with the Chinese leadership, given now that President Xi is now into his next term and the new set of leaders, that it just provided an opportunity for both countries to begin reestablishing those critical relationships that, you know, will they result in something? Why, you know, say, like, is it better to be in the room having discussions or outside of the room trying to listen to the door?
And frankly, when it comes to U.S. and China, two largest economies, two largest carbon emitters, old nuclear weapons, a variety of other interests, having the leaders at least talking to each other and developing ideas to continue the relationship is critical. So I think we're sort of at the restart of the relationship, but I don't foresee it going back to what it was. But I do think it's important that these visits are taking place.
Yeah, absolutely. Congressman Larson, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me. We look forward to more sensible thinking from you on China policy. Let's move on to recommendations. First, a very quick reminder about our upcoming Next China Conference, which is going to be held in New York City on November 2nd in a wonderful event space right on the East River in Midtown East. We have just a great lineup of speakers who are deservedly well-regarded. Our guest from a couple of weeks ago, Yasheng Huang from MIT, is going to be keynoting the conference. Highly interactive breakout sessions where there's just bound to be topics that you're going to be keen on exploring with our speakers. And I'm just really looking forward to this. There's going to be a game show, kind of like Jeopardy, but I'm going to call it something that doesn't violate Jeopardy IP. Peril, I'm thinking. Anyway, get your tickets now. Just click on events from our page at thechinaproject.com. All right, let's move on to, hopefully your staff has briefed you on what in the recommendation section is, but Congressman Larson, what's your recommendation?
I'm reading a book right now, Path Lit by Lightning. It's David Moranis' biography of the greatest athlete of all time, Jim Thorpe. And yeah, it's a great book. Even when I grew up, and I'm 58, I knew who Jim Thorpe was. Jim Thorpe, yeah. We knew he was the greatest athlete of all time. And it is it's a fascinating book, both about his athleticism, about the challenges that he had in his life, both family and alcoholism that impacted him and many other Native Americans in the country. The whole issue of Indian boarding schools is covered in this book as part of the biography. And so a real challenging book for Americans to read, because you're looking at both a human character who had this great reputation, but as well lived through a system that did not treat him well and many other people well, the Native Americans in the United States. So just a really great book, about two-thirds of the way through it now, and I recommend Dave Moranis' book, Path Lit by Lightning, biography of Jim Thorpe.
This sounds fantastic. I grew up in upstate New York, and next door to us was a family, Jim Thorpe and Jim Thorpe Jr., and they claimed relation. They were both, they had Native American blood in them. It was pretty obvious. I mean, they were.
I don't know, but that's the other thing about Jim Thorpe. He's a baseball player. He was the first president of what became the National Football League. So his sports background is important to sports history in the United States. His Olympic gold medals have been formally returned, posthumously reawarded to him as well. But it just there are a lot of aspects of American history in the 1900s that Jim Thorpe touched. But now, as well, as I want to make a note too, we're now dealing with some of that legacy by trying to address the horrors of the Indian boarding school history as well. And there's a big chunk of it in the book that's all about that as well.
That was great. Yeah, when we reinstated his gold medals, that was excellent. All right. My recommendation is, I just got back from another trip where I dropped my daughter off up in Madison, Wisconsin, and my wife and I took on Labor Day. We drove down to the Driftless area. This was at the recommendation of actually a friend of mine, Paul Heer, who you might know. He was the Office of National Intelligence. He was the China director for many years during the Obama administration. He suggested we go down to the Driftless area, which is southwestern Wisconsin, northwestern Illinois, and southeastern Minnesota. And we drove around there. Taliesin is there, Frank Lloyd Wright's home. There's a lot of actually Frank Lloyd Wright architecture there, but just the physical location. This is where the area of the northern Midwest where that wasn't covered in ice sheets. So it remains, it's still very, very hilly and absolutely gorgeous. Natural canyons and kind of limestone formations and beautiful, just beautiful country. Some of the most beautiful country in America I have ever seen. Highly recommend it. Just driving through there. Highlights are, I think there's a cave there. It's pretty impressive. It's called Cave of the Mounds. And then another place we went to is Governor Dodge State Park, with lots of good hiking. It was real hot, but it's gorgeous. So that is my recommendation for the week. If you're out in that part of the world, check out the Driftless area. All right. Thank you once again. It was such a pleasure to have you on, and really great to see you again, Congressman Larson.
Great to be on. Good to see you again, Kaiser.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by the China Project and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced and edited by me, Kaiser Guo. We would be delighted if you would drop us an email at seneca@thechinaproject.com or just give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, as this really does help people discover the show. Meanwhile, follow us on Twitter, or as it's now called, X or something, or on Facebook or on any of the other damn socials at The China Proj. And be sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.